From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. They were so close. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill looked like they were ready to sign on to a $700 billion bailout of the financial markets. Then, well, politics got involved, including presidential politics. Add on to that a bank failure and a threatened but revived presidential debate, and we've got plenty for the folks on our reporters' roundtable to talk about. With us, Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and Marcus Mabry, the international business editor for the New York Times. Hi, guys.
Hi, how are you?
Is there enough going on for us to talk about? I mean,
so boring, isn't it?
It is. You know, you have those slow news weeks. Anyway, let's start with these negotiations over the financial bailout package. The talks broke down. They're back on. At the time of this show, no deal has been announced. Clarence, you're in D.C. What do you think made the talks break down?
Certainly when Senator Shelby from Alabama from the Senate Finance Committee came out and said that they don't have a deal, that was an indication that they didn't. Other than that, even before that happened, there was talk about arguing and even shouting in the room. The big summit that President Bush pulled together of Republicans and Democrats. There are some key philosophical differences here as to what kind of regulation is needed now to prevent this kind of failure again. But even before that, there's the question about the package itself, whether the $700 billion is realistic, how it should be doled out. It's probably not going to be doled out all at once. Senator Chuck Schumer's idea of doling out, I believe, $250 million initially is probably closer to what's going to happen with the final agreement. There will be a final agreement of some kind. Exactly when it's going to happen and what form it will take, we don't know.
Marcus, I'm hearing all sorts of things from people on the street and as well as people in the media. This is a good deal just for the banks. It's not good for the people. This is good for the people and good for the banks. It's neither good for the banks nor good for the people. Where is the crux of the decision-making leading us in terms of responsibility for financial decisions already made and also the court of public opinion?
Well, it's interesting. I think those things may be diverging and not for the good, actually. I think there's no question. It is a good deal for the banks. It's their responsibility. We could see more banks going under, as we just saw Washington Mutual go under just overnight. We could see more bank failures. That was the largest bank failure by a factor of 10, $300 billion we've ever seen in this country. But what that points out to us is that it's not a question of the bank's interest versus the public interest at this point. Our interests are that these banks survive. These are the banks that give loans to us. Right now we have a credit market. Don't look at the stock market. Look at the credit market. That's where we actually have banks lending to each other and to companies and to consumers. No one is lending money to anyone right now. Our economy is basically frozen when it comes to the credit markets. And that's the stuff that lubricates our economy. Right now everyone is waiting for there to be a deal. I think, you know, from a political point of view, I think it doesn't look very good for Senator McCain right now because he raced down there and he said he was, you know, going to be there. And as he said, as we quote in the front page of the Times today, he had said, you know, I'll let you be the judge of how much of I have to do with a deal that comes about. Well, as Barney Frank, the chairman of the House Finance Committee, said, they had the basic outlines of a deal. Chris Dodd, a Republican senator from Connecticut, said that serious Republicans had a deal. And then John McCain got down there, and the House Republicans were revolting, as Groucho Marx might say, and there was no deal. Right now, we have the House Republicans and Senator McCain who are revolting, and Senator McCain not even stating clearly what he thinks should be the deal. It's an incredible political brinksmanship that's backfired and may eventually backfire right into the homes and the offices and the workplaces of Americans.
Clarence, what about presidential politics in this? You had this very unprecedented situation of the major party candidates sitting down with the president, no one particularly happy, but there is a very unusual role that the presidential candidates have played in this whole negotiation, considering particularly that neither of them were involved with the committees that really dealt with this kind of financial issue.
That's right.
What's going on here?
Well, What has happened is that the candidates, led by John McCain, as you just heard, have nationalized this this debate, or I should say, they've put the presidential race right in the center of this debate, which has actually helped abolish up the works, and it's put McCain on the spot now, where he's inserted himself into the middle, but then not taken much of an active role, and I think. Marcus is right that it has backfired. At the same time, Senator Obama has not been terribly outspoken, been more cautious, which tends to be his style, and he'll probably come out the winner in the end as a result of that, because at least nobody can blame him for having made things more difficult. So McCain has now agreed to debate, so we'll wait and see how it looks afterwards. But I think that the general sense is that debate itself is going to wipe out memories of the role that McCain and Obama played in these initial negotiations.
Marcus, this is supposed to be a foreign policy debate, and yet the discussion this week has very much been about domestic economics. So how do you think that's going to play out as the candidates try to debate?
Already we've had the moderator, Jim Lehrer, come out and say he will ask questions about the economy right off the bat. He will talk about this financial crisis that that we and therefore the world is facing right now, and then he will talk about foreign policy as well. But they are not going to try to avoid the elephant in the room, which is the economic situation. In many ways, I think it's very illustrative of this entire presidential campaign. Remember, this is foreign policy was supposed to be a big issue. Iraq was supposed to be a big issue. Well, as it turns out, we're in the midst of an economic downturn, the depth of which we don't really know yet. Usually you understand these things after the fact. And so it's actually being foreign policy has been displaced in the campaign and is going to be displaced to some extent tonight by economic issues. They will certainly talk about foreign policy. They have 90 minutes. That's plenty of time to talk about foreign policy. And I think there we'll see very stark contrast in views. I think Obama will talk a lot more about the importance of diplomacy and reestablishing America's position in the world, both from a hard power point of view, meaning militarily, but also from a soft power point of view, meaning when it comes to things like suasion and things like economic and cultural and social viability, where I think McCain's going to talk a lot more about strength, military strength, determination, experience, all things that play to his strong suit. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out because, again, everyone's going to be thinking about their bank account, the solvency of their own bank, the stability of their own finances, while we're watching them talk about the world and world affairs.
Before I get to you, Clarence, because I'm going to ask you the same thing, with all that's been going on in and around Pakistan, how does that impact what's going on in the U.S. domestically? What's the point of intersection? Marcus.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought this was for Clarence. This is a tough one. I mean, in a way, and as someone who cares deeply about foreign policy, I can't wait to see how they answer these questions because this has been a horrible week for the markets and for all of us who are concerned about financial stability. But it's also been a horrible week for American foreign policy. The few accomplishments, and I think any objective person would have to say there are only a few accomplishments that the Bush administration has made in its 7.5 years in power when it comes to foreign policy, are unraveling. A deal with North Korea, one of the few successes, a deal with North Korea to get them to dismantle their nuclear program, well, that's unraveled. The North Koreans saying we're going to go back in and reestablish after destroying part of our reactors, we're going to go back in and reestablish a nuclear program. So you have a nuclear Iran on the horizon as well as a nuclear North Korea. Pakistan, of course, is now firing on American troops who crossed the border. Pakistan was the Bush administration's greatest ally in the region in the war on terror, other than Iraq, of course, where we invaded and helped establish the government that is currently ruling that country. So it's extraordinary.
Clarence, how do you think these foreign policy issues are going to affect our ability as a nation to deal with the economic issues and the other political issues domestically?
Well, in the short term, the Americans are saying make the world go away. They're not paying attention to those other issues. They're simply being overshadowed at a time when the collapse of WaMu, the biggest bank collapse in history, is kind of relegated to below the fold in newspaper terms. It's hard to get much attention to Pakistan, even though we should. There's a dangerous pattern developing when you see Russia's moves in Georgia, when you see Pakistan troops firing at our troops across the border, and the weaknesses that we know about of Pakistan's existing central government. These are very dangerous times that certainly are going to be very significant for whoever the next president is going to be, and may even emerge as an issue yet before November. But I tend to doubt it. I think right now the economy is really going to hold center stage for a while.
All right. I'm going to ask more about this when we come back from a break. We have a tiny bit of time before a break. But Marcus, do you think that Sarah Palin's interview has made a difference in people's opinion of her or of her ticket?
Well, the question is, I don't know how many people have seen her interview, and particularly the interview with Katie Couric twice on CBS in two different pieces. And she had a Charlie Gibson ABC interview before that. Right now, certainly the media critics' point of view is that she's not been impressive. There's certainly some reason to believe from opinion polls that the bloom is off the rose, that her popularity is not what it was when she was originally introduced. I think really the But when the Americans will really focus in on her will be at the vice presidential debates next week. That will really be her opportunity. And if she has better answers than she has so far, then I think everything else would be forgiven. But she has to get better answers than she's given so far.
This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We have more of our Reporters Roundtable with Marcus Mabry, the international business editor for the New York Times, and Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. So before we took a little break, we were talking a little bit about this interview that Sarah Palin gave, a follow-up interview with Katie Couric. And the word mocked came up about what people had thought of her before. And now she's still being mocked, particularly for a comment that had to do with the proximity of Alaska to Russia and flight patterns of planes. Clarence, do you think that she is being overly criticized, or is this fair game?
Well, she did complain of being mocked by the media, but Katie Couric asked her several follow-up questions in regard to Alaska's relations to Russia, and she made the mistake, in my view, of trying to inflate the role of Alaska in our relations with Russia, talking about trade policy and how critical the trade relationship was between Alaska and Russia. It turned out that Russia ranked way down as far as trading partners went with Alaska. And when she was directly asked what role she had played in relations with Russia, she really didn't have an answer. So it really kind of dug the hole deeper for her, insofar as the jokes that have been made about being able to see Russia from her house. Marcus is right. Everybody's waiting for the debates to see with her against Joe Biden, who also has a reputation for sticking foot in mouth, which he enhanced this past week. Everybody's mm-hmm. waiting to see who will make the most gaffes during that debate.
Yeah, Marcus, I heard it. Mm-hmm.
Well, talk about, the goal in before these debates is always to talk down expectations so that everyone has a low expectation of your candidate. So they think your candidate, if they even do a mediocre job, it looks good because you've deflated expectations so much. Well, that should not be a problem with next week at this point. I think expectations are low for both of those candidates.
All right. Well, Marcus, I know that you were a correspondent for Newsweek in South Africa, and I want to move on to another nation which is having big political news. The South African president, Thabo Mbeki, stepped down this week under party pressure. A former anti-apartheid leader, Kgalema Motlanthe, has become the country's new president. What can you say about him?
It's interesting. He's incredibly popular in the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, which, of course, was the party that battled apartheid for decades, and the party of Nelson Mandela. And Nelson Mandela, of course, the senior statesman of all Africa, who's been ailing, of course, who's incredibly advanced in age now. I think South Africa is missing him greatly. Certainly international investors are not taking the kind of change in leadership well in South Africa. This new president is just a caretaker. He's just a president until Jacob Zuma, who's the head of the ANC and who will almost certainly, and almost certainly minus some calamity we cannot foresee, will become the president of South Africa. Many international investors are worried about him. South Africa depends to a great extent on foreign capital coming into the country and developing it. It is still trying to overcome the legacies of apartheid. And so they're going to have to do a lot to reassure investors. To some extent, the new president helps because he's going to keep on people like Trevor Manuel, the finance minister, who's greatly respected. But there's going to be a real kind of transition here in South Africa, and the country's going to have to reassure foreign markets, especially at a time in which foreign markets are a very jittery period, given the American financial crisis.
Clarence, we just talked a bit about how the U.S. is kind of, you know, circling the wagons because we feel threatened. But South Africa is, as Marcus mentioned, this huge economic engine, not just in and of itself, but for the entire region. So right. If there's some, you know, political wibble wobbles there, do you think that that could throw off other Southern African or African nations?
Oh, no question about it. South Africa is the economic engine. I've been there several times over the last 25 years since the apartheid days, and this is an intriguing period. Jacob Zuma is a man who's very popular. He comes out of the labor movement over there, which is important. I think we might see more pressure on people like Robert Mugabe with Zuma moving up. These are the kind of changes the world is looking at, because South Africa is the central economic power for the region. It is also a very, very important strategic and diplomatic power. There are a lot of reasons why Jacob Zuma could be the key person to help to move the continent further toward the new Africa leadership we've talked about, away from the old big man style of people like Robert Mugabe.
Marcus, to wrap this up, what do you see ahead for South Africa in the next, say, 10 years? I mean, and what I mean by that's a big question, but let me say very specifically, do you think South Africa will play an activist role in regional governments like Zimbabwe? It's kind of gone back and forth on that. What do you think will happen with South Africa, not just as an economic engine, but as a political engine?
Well, you know, it can't help but be a strong player in the region, and therefore in the world. Even despite these problems we're having economically in our country right now, it is a small, increasingly smaller, interconnected, globalized world. South Africa, as the leader on the continent, and they're kind of, you know, two poles in sub-Saharan Africa, one being Nigeria, one being South Africa, those two countries have great importance both economically and politically. South Africa will continue to be a main mover on the continent politically. It's just a question of how they want to move it. There's no question they will continue to be a regional powerhouse.
Well, gentlemen, there's always plenty to talk about with you guys, and it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were speaking with Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. He joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., and Marcus Mabry, the international business editor for the New York Times. He joined us from our NPR studios in New York City.